Hello and welcome to a new episode of LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard. This is a little bit different of an episode than we've had in the past. Derek Walchek, my regular co-host, he went to Consensus and he interviewed three different project founders. And these interviews are fairly short and they're already on YouTube if you subscribe to the YouTube channel. If you don't subscribe to the YouTube channel, check that out because there are videos that don't go on to the podcast feed if they're more visual in nature. And sometimes things like this can hit the YouTube channel a little quicker than the podcast feed depending on how it's structured. Anyway, so we're going to compile these three interviews and it'll make it around an hour-long episode, but they're broken roughly into thirds. They're each 18 to 20 minutes or so, and I think that you'll enjoy them. The first is with a project called Fetch, fetch.ai. It's really interesting. Thoroughly enjoyed that interview. Derek talked to Toby Simpson, who is the CTO of Fetch, and it's a AI-based project, and it really reminds me of the Oasis, if any of you are familiar with Ready Player One, as in terms of what they're trying to build. So that's a great interview. And then he also interviewed the CEO of Haven. Haven is a stablecoin. And we're going to have more information about stablecoins. And in the podcast episode that's already out, that's kind of his wrap-up from Consensus, we dug into stablecoins more than I expected us to. But Haven is one of those stable coins. We got another episode coming that we recorded actually like a month ago with another stable coin founder. And you can get an idea for the model for stable coins if you listen to that one. And then the third one is with the founders of a project called Platin. And Platin is this idea of putting your location and doing various things with your location, putting that on the blockchain. I think you may find interest in that as well. It's a more niche project for sure, but it's got a lot of interesting components, applying proximity-based gamification or even using it for humanitarian purposes and things like that. So that's the three interviews. We've also got a lot more coming with LedgerCast. I hope that you're enjoying what you've seen so far. I've got a sponsor, a partner that is getting going with me right now, and you'll start hearing about them in the next episode. Anyway, if you enjoy the show, be sure to rate us on iTunes and all that kind of stuff. I never really ask that type of thing, but it would be super helpful. And with that, let's dig into these interviews.
So Derek Walchek coming to you live from Consensus 2018 in New York. I'm excited this morning because we're going to be interviewing Fetch.ai, which is a completely very interesting and large project. It's very different than anything that I've seen that's being pitched around up here. So this morning we have Toby Simpson. Toby, will you introduce yourself?
Yep. Hi, I'm Toby Simpson. I'm the CTO and co-founder of Fetch.ai.
All right. So, Toby, we were talking a little bit earlier. You were involved in some video games in the 90s that had some popularity?
Yeah, absolutely. I was doing computer games throughout the 90s, but I had the privilege of involved in a product called Creatures in the mid to late 90s. Creatures was an example of artificial life. And what I really liked about it, other than the fact that it showed me that nature has a lot to offer when it comes to showing how you can solve the problems of artificial intelligence, is that it used a large population of simple things that work together and solve big complicated problems without me actually having to know quite how those problems were solved. And I was kind of curious at the time as to whether or not that bottom-up philosophy of building these large populations of simple things could be used to solve bigger problems, such as creating huge virtual worlds and filling them with different things. I did that for a while in the early 2000s and spent a little while at DeepMind looking at how nature can contribute towards artificial general intelligence. And then got involved in doing Fetch because myself and the other two co-founders of Fetch, one way or the other, have been talking for the last 10 to 15 years about how we could construct a world of such magnitude that we could do really interesting economic work inside it. And then, of course, along comes decentralized ledger technologies and we suddenly realized, well, hey, now we can actually create something of the scale that we need in order to be able to do the kind of things that we want to do.
So you mentioned there's two other partners, two co-founders, I assume. Tell me about them, who they are, and kind of their backgrounds.
Yep. Well, there's Haman Sheikh, who's the CEO, and he also has a background in some areas of computer games and a lot of AI, and also commodities training and supply chains. And there's Professor Thomas Hain, who's Professor of Machine Learning at the University of Sheffield in the UK.
Okay. So getting into Fetch, so we were discussing off camera, and you were helping me to break it down into some base parts. Give me the high-level explanation of what the problem you're trying to solve and how you're going about that.
We live in an increasingly complicated and very, very busy world that has more and more moving parts. And one of the problems with looking after so many moving parts in such a complex environment is it gets very, very hard to do that from the top down. And we wanted to create a scenario where if you could give all those individual moving parts their own autonomy, their own lives, their own ability to control their destinies and exchange value, that you could solve these complex problems that we're presented with from the bottom up. So without you having to go out looking for solutions, the solutions could find themselves and present themselves to you.
So you have these, you call them agents?
Yes.
So these agents would be the base, would be the very base level of a autonomous thing that would live on phones, sensors, cars, basically grabbing data and then figuring out how or serving up opportunities for you to commoditize that data and selling. Is that how it works?
Yes, you can look at it as digital representatives. Pretty much any device, any piece of information, services, people, hardware could be represented by a digital entity that's able to go out and do things on its own behalf. So what we've actually created and what Fetch is a decentralized digital world in which useful economic activity can take place. That economic activity is done by these agents. We call them autonomous economic agents. And they can work on your behalf, on their own behalf, and they can work together as groups or indeed individually. And they live in a world which is structured and adjusted in real time just for them. And that's one of the things that's really exciting about it, that they go into a digital world, and I refer to it as the ultimate dating agency for value providers, that actually restructures itself in real time to present in front of you all the things that are most relevant to what it is that you want to do. And that, we call that the open economic framework. It's the digital world itself. It's effectively the eyes, ears, senses. It gives you an ability as a digital entity to walk around and explore this amazing space, delivering value and finding the things that you want to find. But all this has to be underpinned by something, and that's underpinned by our smart ledger. And we had to do a great number of things with that in order to make it work. And due to the huge scale of the kind of things that we're trying to do with Fetch, where potentially tens, hundreds of millions, or even billions of digital entities might be transacting and exchanging value on a network, and that required some interesting new innovations to make something like that scale and work.
So without getting into your patented stuff or however, without getting into the secrets, can you illustrate a little bit more like how you overcame some of those problems?
Yeah, absolutely. One of them is creating a ledger that really scales. When you're looking at the kind of transaction counts that we're talking about, you need something that will just continue to scale so that if huge numbers of agents are doing things, then you have the ability to push those transactions through. And to do that, we've came up with a whole new approach to creating a ledger. It's a combination of a variety of things, but one of the things that we worked out was how to parallelize transactions that don't affect each other. But then what was really interesting about it is the job of organizing those transactions effectively in order to parallelize them to the maximum level that you can is actually done by the users of the network as part of the proof of work, as forming consensus. And we call that useful proof of work because the actual nodes on the network, as part of building and optimizing the blocks, are actually increasing the throughput and the performance of the network. And we've had to add, for example, to that a side DAG, I guess I would call it, a directed acyclic graph that stores the results of that useful proof of work and provides an election mechanism in order to ensure that there is a selection process for choosing the best block in order to go onto the network. And using this, we've been able to achieve a huge number of transactions. But what we really realized with useful proof of work is we didn't have to stop with block optimization. We could actually use that to solve other machine learning and AI problems. And we can use that to build a prediction model so that we could deliver predictions to the users of the network, but also trust information. And trust information is really interesting because if you had to wait for a given transaction to go to the global state before you were able to continue, that may only be half a second or a second. But if there's 100 transactions involved, that potentially all adds up. That's a long time. And the trust mechanism that we've got, which as the transactions go onto the network and move around, they get signed, it gets put through a Bayesian network and delivers this real-time trust information, means you can look at any given transaction and go, oh, right, yeah, that one's got a 97% chance of making it to the global state. I'll go with it. And that means you can make those decisions very, very quickly. And that also dramatically improves the throughput of a network like that.
So the base layer, the network, did you fork that from Ethereum or did you come up with your own basic?
Yeah, we had to come up with our own in order to make that work. The problems that we were dealing with were very, very different. The scalability that we needed to achieve, that was something that we couldn't do. But also, we couldn't afford for information, key information about the value exchanges that take place to be lost. As part of a settlement process or anything like that, the machine learning algorithms and as part of the useful proof of work mechanism needs access to that information as it goes by. So that did require a very different structure. But also we're doing something very differently. This isn't just a case of allowing large numbers of transactions to go through. This is a decentralized digital world. So we're trying to add geography to this network. This is Web 3.0 as a place that you go. We want it to be possible for agents to be able to say, I want to know what's going on in that direction, or over there, or behind me, or within a range. Because a number of the big problems that get solved, things like transportation issues and other complex solutions for users, involve things that are geographically based as a method of sorting. And that digital world, in a multi-dimensional way, also required a whole bunch of different structures at the raw network level.
So tell me about the different verticals. Tell me about maybe two or three verticals and then go deep into one and explain how Fetch will solve problems.
Well, as we touched on before we started recording this, right. We were talking off camera, you said that one of the problems with a thing like Fetch, where you could potentially have a digital representative for almost everything. And when you think about the amount of data that we use right now, what's more interesting is actually the amount of data that we simply don't use, either because we don't know it's there or because the cost to extract it and deliver it exceeds its value. Of course, when you can attach a digital representative to everything, then that cost plummets. You can bring all this stuff into play, which is really interesting. But when you're sitting in a world where you could do anything and everything, how on earth do you know where to start? So that's one of the things that was very important with Fetch. We had to look at all this and think, okay, well, we do need to focus this in some of the areas where we know that this technology can make a great deal of difference. Areas where there are a great number of moving parts that could genuinely be improved, the experience for everybody. The utilization values could go up, it's a better experience for users. And of course, transport is exactly one of those things where if you put representatives on pretty much everything that surrounds you, you can buy from those in front and you can sell to those behind you. You've got this shifting wave of useful information that can improve the experience for all, but it can be delivered to you rather than you having to go out and find it. And ultimately, as the world changes and you can automate individual segments of roads and other bits and pieces, then there's more control afforded to this complex system. You can poke it in different ways. You can manage it in different ways. You can deal with the peaks and the troughs. You can flatten the demand and make the whole experience better for everybody. So transport was definitely one of those areas where we realized that Fetch could make a great deal of difference. And it's certainly one of the areas that we're concentrating on. But also supply chain management. There's a lot of areas there when you look at certain parts of supply chain management, and it really does look like a journey into the past, where utilization is not nearly as good as it could be, but it's because it's a lot of moving parts, and one top-down entity finds it very hard to hold the entire problem in their mind.
Right.
But if you can put that out into the individuals to solve by themselves, the digital ones, without you having to worry about it, you get a better flow, but a more adaptive and dynamic flow.
So I understand. So how do the individual sensors or the individual agents have a concept of the problem that they're trying to solve?
They have a concept of what it is that they have. It's the network that builds the solutions to the problems by connecting people who want that information or who might want it.
Okay.
So an individual agent representing whether or not a windscreen wiper is functioning in a car or a vehicle at any given moment doesn't know where it's going to be able to deliver that value or how it's going to be able to deliver that value. The network, when it goes into the network will position it. Again, this is the dating agency for value providers. Mm-hmm. It will put it in a world tailored and adapted just for it, where everything it sees are things that are most likely to want that information. And we use a number of machine learning techniques, including a really neat reinforcement learning system, because, of course, we know whether any given prediction or correlation that we deliver, we know whether it works, because we can see whether any value was exchanged as a result of it. So the ones that aren't working, well, we can degrade those out of the system. And the ones that are, we can reinforce them and give them strength. And that allows the network to adapt very, very quickly, but also to explore new interactions between things that are non-obvious.
Yes.
And that's what's really interesting, the idea that non-obvious correlations will be drawn by the network just because it watches what's going on, which introduces more opportunities to use this value and for that to just to be handled as a fact that you're in fetch as opposed to anything else. So no, you don't need to know. These entities don't need to know where they're going to deliver it. The network will ensure that people that can use it are right there.
Okay, so how does fetch make money? I mean, I could imagine some different business plans, but help me understand how the network will make money.
Fetch is an example of a tokenized thing. It's a non-permissioned public network, so anybody and everybody is able to set up nodes, but also to set up and build their own autonomous economic agents. It's one of those things that is open to all. So as people proceed to work with the network and they do things with the network, then the values of the predictions and the correlations that are delivered, that gains in value. So all users and stakeholders in the network gain value as the network grows and is used by more people.
Okay. All right. So what is the roadmap ahead for Fetch? What does the next couple of years look like?
Very busy. Very busy. But what we do have right now is internally we have a private test network that's actually up and running. So our key innovations, particularly relating to the ledger and the machine learning side, the useful proof of work and the virtual machine that drives that, we actually have all those things up and running. And the initial digital world, we have that working too. So you can actually build agents, and we have done, and you can put them in this world. They can find each other and they can exchange value. And all of that happens on the Fetch network. Over the summer, we're looking at a public testnet release. That's really exciting because that means that anybody and everybody will be able to try things, to see what they can build. They can attach digital representatives to all sorts of things and just see what happens in this network. And that's super exciting. I can't wait to see what people will build with that. And towards the back end of the year, as we add more of the machine learning and the artificial intelligence to the system, that network will slowly fill out with all the functionality that we're talking about. And we're looking at a main network release towards the back end of the first half of next year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you mentioned that you'll have tokens. With the sale of tokens, or I know you didn't want to get into the details, and you don't have to, but is that probably a 2019 deal?
We haven't made any announcements about that. Okay. This is a tokenized business, and actually that's very, very important because you want it to be able to want people, no matter where they are. This is an inclusive network to be able to perform these things, and you need some common method of being able to do that over the network. So we've had to come up with a method of doing that, and a tokenized business is by far the best way of achieving that, particularly given the underlying decentralized ledger technologies.
Okay, that makes sense. So, all right, so before we talk about how listeners can participate and interact. Is there anything else you wanted to explain or a question that I didn't ask that I should have relative to your project?
No, I think we did pretty good. For me, the idea, when we're sitting here in the real world, the two of us in this room, we have to see the same world, albeit from a slightly different perspective. With a digital world, there is no such restriction. And that, to me, is really exciting because something can be close to you, even if it's not physically close to you, just because it's important to you. And having the Fetch digital world restructure that for every individual so that it is perfect for value exchange, that's one of the things that excites me most. And being able to build a virtual world of this magnitude that could keep getting bigger with a population of this size in it, well, the kind of things that billions of autonomous economic agents might be able to achieve if they work together, well, who knows where that might go. But that's a dream come true for me, given all the work I've done with virtual worlds and digital worlds, to allow so much useful work to be able to take place in something of this size.
It reminds me of a quote, and I can't remember who said it, but it may have been Jack Dorsey. I can't remember who it was, but he basically said that the closest thing to digital life that he's ever seen is the blockchain. And so this certainly goes to reinforce the idea of that, because you're creating these autonomous agents that can do things, and then they interact with the ledger, who then can take the information they've given and create relationships and opportunities to commoditize it. And find relationships that humans probably couldn't even have concept of, which is completely fascinating. So for listeners, how can they interact with Fetch? What would you like for them to do?
Come and join us on Telegram. Come and ask us questions and try and imagine amazing things that you could do with this. Because what we've managed to come up with is merely the tip of the iceberg. I think your quote there was really interesting. When you get all these little things working together, who knows what might emerge? I mean, it is a great example of a life form, a new form of economic life in the case of Fetch.
Yeah, very good. Toby, I'll tell you, Toby Simpson, and probably he will have the absolute best accent of anyone that I will interview here at Consensus, without a doubt. It's fantastic. Where specifically, where did your accent come from?
That's an interesting, tough one because it came from my mother more than anything else. But a combination of different places in the UK, the south of England, the east of England, and now in Cambridge. Okay. So it's sort of a mixture of all of those joined together.
It's very good. It's different than my southern drawl. Very good. Okay, so we'll have in the show notes, we'll have information on how you can get in touch with Fetch. But for Telegram, it's Fetch_AI. Toby, thank you so much. I think this has been great. Very good.
Thank you very much.
Derek Walchek here, coming to you from Consensus 2018. Really excited. One of my favorite themes and favorite areas in crypto to invest in are in stablecoins. I just think it's going to be a really big field. Its use case is potentially even bigger than crypto itself. So just full disclosure, I'm an investor in this project. I believe in it, but we're going to go into all the details. So I've got Kane Warwick with me here, with Haven. Kane, you introduce yourself?
Hi, thanks very much for having us on the show. I'm Kane, the founder of Haven, and we're a decentralized payment network.
All right, so you're a stablecoin. Some of our listeners may have no concept of what that actually means. Why don't you explain to us what a stablecoin is?
So I think generally stablecoins are intended to track some external value. Typically, it's the US dollar. It can be gold. It can be other things. But the idea is that because crypto assets are very volatile, you want something that can essentially allow people to have a unit of account that is stable. And that's going to enable a whole bunch of things within crypto that right now are very hard to do. So long-term contracts, insurance, lending, etc. It's very hard because if you're lending Ethereum or Bitcoin, it can get really ugly really fast. So you want something that's going to be stable that you can use within those systems. So that's the idea of a stablecoin. That's what we're trying to solve, to create essentially what Bitcoin was supposed to be, a cash system, right? So you need stability if you want to build a cash system.
Yeah, and I think that's something that people, once they kind of get into crypto and they start to understand, they think Bitcoin can be this thing that you use instead of cash, but it, you know, the volatility is amazing, you know, down 70% from the peak last year. And, you know, that you could either be to the good or to the bad in that type of situation. And some argue that eventually Bitcoin will reach such a critical mass that the, you know, the price swings will be sort of like gold, which might be 10 to 15% a year, but we're not there yet. So therefore the need for stable coins. Why don't you tell us about the different types of stable coins and the way that stable coins try to keep their peg to the dollar?
So broadly, there's three categories of stablecoins. A lot of people would have heard of Tether. So Tether is an off-chain collateral solution. So the idea being that you take dollars, you put them on deposit in a bank somewhere, and against each dollar, you issue a token. That's the most viable solution we have right now, but obviously it's not very decentralized. So that's a very centralized solution. You've got a single point of failure, one entity or one company or one group of people that's administering, you know, in the case of Tether, it's $2.5 billion. So, you know, the challenge there is that if a government or regulator decides that that's not a good idea, you know, it could potentially be shut down, which hasn't happened yet, but, you know, it's a risk that people assume. So Digix is another example of that. They use gold. And then the second category is on-chain collateral. The best example of which, you know, that's trading right now is Maker. So Maker uses at the moment, Ethereum, that you can stake Ether into a CDP, a collateralized debt position, and issue a stablecoin against it. And then the third one, which is still very theoretical, is algorithmic solutions. So Basis and a number of other projects, Carbon, are trying to work on essentially a non-collateralized, just managing the supply to maintain the price. So those are the three categories at the moment that are sort of viable.
We'll get into yours specifically, obviously, but the algorithmic is interesting to me because it's almost like if it can work, you get a free lunch. You don't really have to back it with anything. It's the math, which essentially is what the central bank does here in the United States and elsewhere around the world. Do you have any thoughts on that as a model?
So I think it's the most challenging one to solve. I have a view, you know, if you go back to pre-Bitcoin days, a lot of people were skeptical that we would be able to solve the double spend problem. And then all of a sudden someone was able to put together a whole bunch of different aspects of technology that was kind of in existence into a system in Bitcoin that allowed for, you know, decentralized consensus, which was pretty amazing. But when you look back at it, you know, you can kind of trace back the history and you can kind of see that in some ways it was inevitable. But when you look at an algorithmic solution to stability, it's easy to kind of dismiss it and say it's not possible, it can't work. But people who dismiss things and say they can't work on principle, unless you can demonstrate that it is not actually possible, it's a bad side of the bet to be on often. You know, because where there's a lot of incentive for people to build something, oftentimes it'll get built. So it's really a sort of academic question at the moment. Is this a thing that is possible to happen? And I'm skeptical of people who sort of dismiss it out of hand. I think it's going to be a very challenging problem and it's going to take a while. So for us, being on-chain collateral, our view is path to market is much, much simpler. It'll be much faster. And if we're able to get in market, scale fast, we can potentially put enough distance between ourselves and, you know, the algorithmic solutions that it'll be hard for them to catch up in the same way that you know, it's hard for people to catch up to Tether at the moment.
Right. So what I wonder, what does Tether think about you guys?
I think the guys from Tether, obviously they've been doing this for a long time. It's a system that works very well for the people who participate in it. And even though there's some skepticism around whether it's collateralized or not, I'm very confident that it is. We work with market makers and a whole bunch of people that, you know, I don't think there's any issue with it being collateralized, but it is still risky. It is still centralized. I think they look at us, all of the stablecoins, and kind of go, come back to us when you've actually got something real in market that can challenge us.
Right. And that's probably fair. Very good. Okay, so we talked about the algorithmic side. We understand just inherently Tether, the way it's backed by the dollar. So go into a little bit of your mechanism and how that actually works. And how you try to keep the peg and the couple different coins that you have to be able to do that.
So our view is that stability is obviously important, but scalability is critical as well. So what we're looking to do is build a scalable solution because, again, Tether has $2.5 billion in circulating currency. So unless we can get to several hundred million or $1 billion in circulating currency, it's going to be difficult to get exchanges and other systems to utilize us. So what we've built is something sort of akin to a closed-loop payment network. So we have two tokens. There's a collateral token and then a stable coin, which is issued against the collateral token. So what happens is people hold the collateral token and they lock it up in a smart contract. And against the value of the collateral token, we issue the stable coins and stable coins are then transacted and fees are charged for the transactions. So in our case, there is no free lunch here. People do have to pay for the utility that they're getting from the system. But our view is that the fees that are being generated by the payment network will allow the system to scale much faster. So what we've seen with Maker is obviously, you know, the limiting factor on scalability for them is getting people to put ETH into these CDPs. And right now they're sitting at about 35 million in circulating currency. So it's hard to incentivize people to stake their ETH. So they're looking at other solutions to help them to scale. In our side, really, it's about transaction volume. If there's enough transaction volume in the system, then we'll be able to scale much faster and get up to, you know, essentially hundreds of millions or even potentially billions of dollars in circulating currency. So that's the mechanism, I guess, at a high level.
All right. So you have the Haven token, the HAV, and that would be the collateral token. And then you have what are called nomins. And right now you have an e-nomin, and then go through that in a little bit.
Sure. So one of the things we wanted to do before we got on mainnet was to test out some of the mechanism aspects. So we built an ETH-backed stablecoin to allow us to test transaction fees and a few other things. So that is, I guess, a provisional stablecoin, if you will, which will be kind of mothballed in the next month or so. But we're right now, in fact, we just last night went into code freeze. So the contracts are being audited for NUSD, which is the Haven-backed Nomen system. So once we launch on mainnet on the 11th of June, the foundation, the Haven Foundation, will be able to stake the Havens, the value of the Havens that we have in our wallet, and issue NUSD, which is a Nomen that's tracking the US dollar, which will give us, at the moment, based on the current price, probably a couple million dollars worth of circulating currency, which will then allow transaction fees to start to be generated. And we've got a whole bunch of real world, examples and adoption that we're working on to generate that transaction volume.
Okay. So you'll create the foundation will actually create those. So for the people who are holding the HAV tokens, at what point will they be allowed to lock them up in a smart contract and actually be able to generate fees?
It's probably going to be a few months after that. One of the things that that we've kind of, I guess, as a principle implemented since the beginning is just being very careful with the system and ensuring that we roll it out in a staged fashion. So we don't want people to be able to put their havens at risk until we're confident that the system is viable. So the foundation's going to take that risk initially. It's probably going to be a few months before we can allow everyone to issue havens. In principle, they can from a technical perspective, but just from a practical rollout perspective, we'd try to stage it.
Right. All right, so if you're creating a stablecoin, one of the problems you have to solve is how do you keep your peg? First of all, you got to be able to determine what is the US dollar worth. And so you use an oracle, which is a seer that tries to find that. What's your oracle system? How do you do that?
So at the moment, that's one of the most centralized aspects of the system. There are a number of projects, Oracleize.it, and a few others that are working on decentralized Oracle solutions. There's Schelling coins and a few other very sort of technical approaches. So this is something that, again, in our sort of staged rollout, we're going to be looking to decentralize over time. So right now it's a centralized oracle. It pulls a price feed from various places where there's liquidity and is able to then send to the contract the value of havens against ETH and the US dollar, once every few minutes.
Okay. All right. So that makes sense. So so one of the critical things is obviously for you to be successful, a lot of people need to use your stablecoin, right, for it to work. Okay, so what is going to drive that use? I was listening to a podcast with Kyle Samani with Multicoin Capital, and he was talking about how he's a believer in stablecoins. I don't think he's invested with y'all, but he's looking, you know, and he's trying to figure out which one he thinks is going to work. And what he said was he didn't think it was necessarily the algorithm or the actual way that the stablecoin works will be the deciding factor. He thinks that eventually everybody will figure out what mechanism works, and you can fork it and just copy that mechanism. But what's going to drive this is adoption. And it's going to be, you know, the way he described it, is a world-class SaaS sales force that gets out there and does that. And I think your background, you have a background in retail and some of the other stuff that you've done prior. What is your plan on going to market and driving adoption?
Yeah, for sure. So I think, you know, again, you need to phase these things, right? So on one hand, the low-hanging fruit for us are crypto projects. So we're partnering with a number of crypto projects that are looking for a stable medium of exchange within their platform. And then from there, you can start to expand into some real-world use cases. So as a proof of concept, we've actually built an e-commerce store where you can go and buy at Haven merchandise, like Haven shirts and hoodies, right, and things like that. But we've also partnered with a third-party logistics company that distributes Apple products.
Right.
So we've got a competition that launched last night where if you make a purchase through the Haven store, you can go in the draw essentially to win EUSD. And you can buy iPhones, you can buy AirPods, a bunch of Apple products. So that for us is really important to demonstrate for merchants the value of accepting cryptocurrency, because I think a lot of them have been hearing about Bitcoin as a solution for payments for a long time, and they've become very skeptical of cryptocurrency because A, people don't like to spend Bitcoin because it's deflationary, so you know they'd rather hold it, right, and wait for the price appreciation. And on the flip side, if you're a merchant and you're accepting it, there's counterparty risk on the exchange rate. You know, if you're a low margin business and you accept Bitcoin as a payment, and you know the price drops 2 or 3%, which can happen over the course of you know a few hours, you either need to have very good hedging, which is expensive, or you need to accept that currency fluctuation risk. So a stablecoin that has all the benefits of crypto, but doesn't have that counterparty risk or minimizes the counterparty risk, I think there's going to need to be a re-education process for merchants. So we want to show them this actually works. You can reduce fraud massively. You can take out a whole bunch of costs. And we're actually doing it now to demonstrate to them that this is a thing. So, right. Yeah.
So you, I mean, was that difficult to get the Apple products? I noticed, I mean, it's, and is there a price discount or is it the same price you pay at the Apple store? How does that work?
Yeah, so at the moment it's the same price, but we are looking at potentially running some discounts to encourage people to buy. Obviously, the competition right now is, you know, one sort of approach to get people to test out the store and generate some volume. We have a, you know, I guess we're probably a more commercial team than we are a technical team. I've been running a company called Blue Shift for the last 4 years, which is in Australia a fiat to crypto payment gateway. So we've got a really solid team there. We've got a lot of good relationships with, you know, both crypto and real world businesses. So we've been able to leverage a lot of those relationships to get things like this over the line. So
obviously you're based in Australia. How is that as a challenge, and then how is that a benefit when you're trying to launch a worldwide currency like this?
The obvious challenge is that, you know, we're in New York, right? So we travel a lot. We've been on the road for the last, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. We've been through Singapore, SF, New York, we're going to be in Korea and China later in the year. So there's a lot of travel because, you know, Australia is very far away. You know, the closest flight for us is really like Singapore, which is 8 hours, right? So that's a short flight for us. So that's just one, I guess, geographic challenge. Although, you know, crypto is a very distributed community, right? So there's people all over the world. So, you know, getting, I guess, getting attention, getting cut through, you end up spending a lot of time at conferences and things like that. The flip side of Australia is that, you know, sovereign risk is very low. It's very stable government. The regulatory environment is very stable. So that reduces some of the risk, I guess, of, you know, any regulatory issues we have with building something like this. I think that, you know, if you're building stablecoin in the US, you have to potentially contend with, you know, scrutiny from the SEC and a bunch of different agencies. You've got all the state-based regulations. So, you know, in Australia, we've got a sort of federalized system. We have one sort of set of laws we have to deal with. It makes it a lot easier for us to operate, you know, this network.
And I was reading, I think it was yesterday, where the Australian government, I don't know where they are in making this law, but they basically said you can't use cash for purchases larger than $10,000. So tell us about that, and then could that possibly be a benefit to what you're doing?
So, you know, I think it's interesting. Australia still has about 30% of transactions are still done in cash. And BlueShift is actually a cash payment gateway. So it allows people to bring cash into a location and convert it into crypto over the counter. We obviously, you know, because it's cash, we tend to do smaller transactions around $2,000 or $3,000. So it's not going to necessarily affect us. But I think the intention is to really try and reduce you know, people coming in and say, you know, buying a $2 million house with a couple of briefcases full of cash. The question, you know, with any regulation like this is, will it actually impede legitimate business more than, you know, the people who are doing illegitimate things? Because most times those people will route around any, you know, they're not going to stop doing what they're doing just because you say it's not okay anymore. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Again, you know, the regulators in Australia have been fairly hands-off with crypto, so I don't think it's necessarily aimed at crypto. I think it's just an effort to try and curb some of the excesses of cash payments that have been happening for a while.
And I guess my question is based in the idea that this would be a cryptocurrency that's a stablecoin that you could track better than you could cash.
Absolutely.
So could you potentially benefit, could Haven benefit from this law?
I think we could benefit from the law. So it's probably worth describing the Haven sort of governance system. So we're a foundation, a not-for-profit foundation that operates out of Australia, and it's a protocol. So we value decentralization and censorship resistance very highly. And our view is that if you want to be a viable, scalable stablecoin, you need to use the same approach to governance as close as possible to you know, things like Bitcoin, right? If we have a system where there's a central point of failure, like, for example, Tether, I don't think we'll be able to scale. So for us, we've open sourced the software. Anyone can, you know, come and work on it. We're looking to build a community around it. And we want to ensure that even if we disappear, that the project will be able to continue to grow. But obviously, you know, in the early days, there's a lot of work for us to actually, you know, advocate and build up the network effects. But ultimately, we want this to be a project that is open source and anyone can work on and is available to anyone to use.
Okay, two more questions. First one, any other aspect of Haven that we didn't discuss or touch on that you'd like to shine a light on?
I think we've covered the majority of it. I mean, you know, again, there's the one of the critical things for people to understand is this dual token mechanism, because it is a bit different than a lot of other projects where they've just got a single token. So the idea that you can hold Havens and that the Havens give you a right to participate in this network and get rewarded with fees is really important. So the collateral token is a free floating token. The price can go up and down. It's the stablecoin that's issued against that value. And ultimately, the value of the stablecoin is in its convertibility to the underlying asset. This is why I think in the short term, collateralized solutions will be far more effective and far easier to implement, because you're basically taking an asset and saying that you can convert this stablecoin into that asset. If the asset maintains its value, which for us is really determined by transaction volume in the network. So if transaction volume is happening, then the system should be very stable. So, you know, that's probably the most critical thing for people to get, is that there are two tokens and that, you know, they have two different sort of functions within the network.
Yeah, I was noticing in your Telegram group that as of today, as of this recording, which is the 15th of May, the price of Haven is around 67, 68 cents.
Yep.
And so you're getting close to a dollar, and people are thinking the HAV token is the stable coin. And they're like, well, why isn't it a dollar? Will it stop at a dollar?
Yeah.
And again, the HAV token is actually the collateral token that essentially, when you lock it up, it'll create nomins. So you want to look at the nomins when it's out.
Yep.
And that you hope that that does stay at a dollar, because that's the goal.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so I assume you'll come back to consensus next year. Okay,
yeah.
So what would be some good yardsticks or some good milestones where, if we're sitting here, we're doing this again a year from now, that you've accomplished maybe X, Y, and Z? What are some things we could try to hold you to?
So obviously mainnet launch on the 11th of June is a critical milestone. Then there's going to be a phased rollout, which will take probably four or five stages every few months. So by the time we get to, this time next year, May next year, I think what we should be looking for is a system that has scaled up to support hopefully a few hundred million dollars worth of circulating currency. I think we'll also have multiple currencies in place. We'll have obviously USD is the initial stablecoin, but in our market in Australia, it's very important that you've got an Australian dollar tracking stablecoin as well. One of the nice things about a collateralized system is you can actually measure that collateral in any fiat currency. So we can support Korean won, we can support RMB, we can support yen, euros, GBP, and we can support them simultaneously. So one of the really strong use cases eventually, once we get to a level of circulating currency to support this, will be overseas remittance to allow people to convert very, very easily and for low fees, various currencies into one another. So yeah.
That's excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Kane. This has been great. Honestly, I've wanted to do this for a long time. So, good luck with the rest of the show.
Okay.
Thank you.
Derek Walchek here at Consensus 2018, last day of Consensus. I'm feeling a little tired, but that's okay. I'm really excited here. Today I've got Alon Mason and Dr. Lionel Wahlberger here with Platin, which is a proof of location-based blockchain protocol. So why don't you introduce yourselves?
Hi, thank you. My name is Alon Mason. I am the CEO of Platin. We're developing a proof of location protocol on the blockchain. I'd be happy to get some questions and answer them and discuss the details of the protocol, types of use cases and apps that we support, and get into the nitty-gritty of what proof of location provides and the business value for various industries.
My name is Lionel Wahlberger. Census event has been really phenomenal, amazing people here. People can really see the revolution that can happen with decentralized protocols and blockchain capabilities. And we're very happy and proud to be bringing to that space a location validation, a location claim. Basically, an ability to do whatever business value proposition you have, but bring your location to bear on it. And these location claims are privacy preserving, cryptographically assured, and we call it Platin.
Very good. It's always fun when you go to these conventions because you never know who you're going to run into, when you're going to run into people. And I think I was checking into my hotel when I ran into Alon on. What night was it? I don't remember what night it was.
It was Monday night.
Monday night. And so we were getting here, and so it was like, hey, what are you doing? What are you doing here for the show? Alon's like, let me show you something. And he pulls out his phone, and he shows me, basically, essentially, puts a Bitcoin on a table and says, okay, you can go get that through his phone virtually. And so I was like, holy cow. My mind was awake and alert. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that and how it relates to the product and what you're trying to create.
Okay, so part of the vision for Platin is born out of our deeply ingrained belief in blockchain and cryptocurrencies, and sort of a disappointment as to why we haven't seen mass adoption with cryptocurrencies around the world. Why I can't pay my rent or pay for parking or most of my daily payments or activities pay with the cryptocurrency. And we realize that there's quite a bit of dissonance with the use cases, not necessarily the use case, but the user experience around how cryptocurrencies work. And when you start talking about cryptocurrencies, you end up pretty quickly with technical discussions about block sizes and cold storage and QR codes, and we really felt that something has to be done to improve the usability around cryptocurrencies. And we, part of our vision was, why don't we make it as simple as Pokemon Go? Why don't we make it as simple as being able to interact with digital currency or Bitcoin through augmented reality so people could actually see and feel and make that experience more tangible and visceral for people. And that demo that I showed you, that capability through the Platin Pocket application where we place a Bitcoin on a table or in the space in front of us and interact with that through augmented reality, we think all of a sudden makes it, you know, clear to people and could potentially bring cryptocurrencies to the masses, maybe has faster adoption.
You think you can send me like a 30-second video of that? Of that, putting a Bitcoin on the table where we can splice it through so you can see that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we can do that with several coins in the space in front of us. Mm-hmm. So we'll do 5 Bitcoin and 5 Ether.
Okay.
And then you can catch that right on.
Exactly. When we tell the story of Platinum, we include a video that we made in Tokyo. We were honored to be selected by the Tokyo Metropolitan Government and the Blockchain Accelerator. We were there along with Toyota, Bitcoin, and other leaders in the blockchain space. So while we were there, we made a video of putting some Bitcoin outside of Tokyo Station, and we have that in our presentation. But of course, it's more fun to see it live. So.
All right. So with blockchain, you know, you establish, obviously it can solve identity problems. Blockchain. How is location a problem that needs to be solved with blockchain technology? Why is that an issue?
So I'll start by saying that location data today is quite centralized with GAFA. So GAFA is an acronym for Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple.
Okay.
They control most of the location data that we have on our devices. And one of the first visions that we have is also to decentralize that data and give the power of your data back to yourself and allow the individual to decide how they want to use the application, how they want to monetize it, whom they want to share it with, and to what extent. Giving the power of your own personal location data back to the individual is something that we really believe in doing. Do you want to add something to that?
Location data can be very sensitive to where you're located. We share our data with the cell phone tower provider. Your cell phone company has to know where you are, but you can get a signal from the US tower. I'm sure you've told your location on your phone for various services like ordering taxis or banking. All this location data is very siloed. It's accumulated in certain verticals. So, FedEx knows where all its packages are located. Google knows where all its identity are. And location is really shared across silos. One reason why it isn't is because it's private. Platinum has spent time with world-class talents to find a way to make location available for the blockchain revolution. What exactly is that revolution? It's the ability to do decentralized and trustless activities without silos, without firewalls, without verticals protecting the data. So, using the Platinum protocol, we can create location claims that are cryptographically bound, they are not inspectable by this data. They are only inspected by that business case that you agree to participate in. We call them PALs, Platinum algorithms, because the topic can get rather complex. So it's taking me a few minutes to explain. But we aim for utter simplicity. That's why our demo is of putting Bitcoins on tables.
Right.
Seems like a game, but Platinum's not a game. There's serious technology behind it. And with the PALs, when you enter the Platinum store and you want to make a location claim, you could choose a PAL that just says I was at a certain GPS location. You could use a PAL that says this is an encrypted claim that can only be opened by certain kinds of enterprises and already given permission in some other setting. You can make a location claim that just reveals that you're at a certain store without naming which branch it was. Using the cleverness of cryptography and zero knowledge, all kinds of tricks to enable location in the blockchain space.
All right, so I'm still having a little bit of trouble fully grasping what it is. So give me, if you will, a specific use case for a company and how they would interact with your blockchain and how they would use the protocol.
All right. So one example would be Starbucks creating the Starbucks token on top of the Platinum protocol. we're allowing Starbucks then to geo-place those tokens outside of any Starbucks in the US, for example. And each airdrop token or geo-place token would have logic built into the policy for that. It can be programmatically changed or adapted to the needs of the policy. So the Starbucks token can say, you know, this token is a spawn between 2 to 5 p.m. when Starbucks has low traffic. That Starbucks token can then be claimed by people in exchange for profit percentage. That's something that we consider commercial or urban airdrops. Are there a type of airdrops that we can see down the line happening, or humanitarian airdrops, individuals donating small amounts of money, cryptocurrency to various regions around the world that are in some humanitarian system?
Just to expand on that, either you mentioned Starbucks because we love their coffee.
Sure.
I'm holding some cash in my hand. Cash, and anybody could pick it up. There's actually no method currently to give digital cash or any kind of digital currency to people that you haven't met yet. You know, you have to know their email or a bank account or some kind of transfer. Using Platinum, just as Alon said, I'm just amplifying it. You could just drop coins into an area for humanitarian needs. So that's one of our primary use cases, because we're very excited by the ability to transfer currency to people in need while bypassing organizations which perhaps might siphon off a good amount of money.
All right, I get it. So basically you are, in a sense, instead of sending a token to a wallet from a wallet, you're basically putting it in a place where someone can find it and come get it. So like if I'm a Starbucks customer, I can essentially play Pokemon Go with the Starbucks token and I can go get it and find it on my phone, which obviously is exciting. I mean, that's my background. We own a bunch of shopping centers and office buildings in the Southeast. And so that's why the location thing is interesting for me, specifically with real estate, because I think that's going to be something that's going to relate to. So there's a couple competitors in the space, or at least that are doing a similar thing, like Sesame Phone. Can you help me understand how you're different than Phone and what they're trying to do and what you're trying to do, how it's different?
Yeah, so Phone is interesting. The way that they see location proofs being done, it's actually based on their own deployment of LoRa beacons. So they are hardware dependent, and Platinum is more hardware agnostic.
What is a LoRa beacon?
Why don't you want to explain a LoRa beacon?
Oh, radio, I mean, it's an acronym.
Okay.
LoRa is what I, first of all, we don't know all the details of what our competitors are doing or other location plays. We do welcome a very robust and competitive location space, because we think location is needed in every business. We like to say location is everywhere. What we have drawn from what Phone is doing, they are basing it on a LoRa beacon. They chose that because it's an unregulated radio space. You know, if they were doing FM radio, it would be nice. So they're somehow incentivizing people to raise these beacons, and then based around that, they'll do some claims. They're doing other interesting things too. They're laying out a language for location in Ethereum. To differentiate us in a nutshell, we are a secure protocol. We have high security. For example, we know the details of doing radio frequency based claims. In fact, LoRa will be quite difficult in the radio spectrum to do that with. We are not Ethereum committed.
Okay.
Phone and many other of the recent location competitors or location service providers are Ethereum based. We love Ethereum, it's amazing, but we see Platinum as being almost blockchain independent. We're forking Ethereum for our beginning, but we're not a smart contract joined protocol. Our protocol is separate from the smart contract. It's a protocol based on location value, location claims, and location credentials.
Okay, that makes sense. So, you want to speak to any other members on your team? You were telling me earlier about a professor that you have that sounds really impressive. and some of his accomplishments.
Sure. That's for me. We really admired Dr. Surjan Kapkin, S-R-G-G-A-N, for quite a while before we actually met him personally. He's the world leader in location, and he's a great showman as well. He's done some fascinating hacks. One of his better known ones in the security community was the proximity key hack. You know, today many automobiles, you just sit in the automobile and close the keys in your pocket. You can then start the car by pushing a button. And then if somebody else can't push that button because they don't have the key in their pocket. So that's a location of technology. The car knows that the key is located in the car. So Dr. Kapkin took two radios. It was rather expensive and difficult at that time. And he put one radio by the bedroom where the person was sleeping with his key, and then with the other radio he entered the car. The car thought the key was in the car and he drove away. So this proved that the location protocol they were using was not secure. He then developed a secure method of doing it and started a company around it. So Dr. Kapkin has almost a boyish enthusiasm for the wonders of location, doing different hacks in the space, and then developing companies and commercializing solutions.
That's really cool. So what does the next 12 months look like for your company? What will you be doing? What is your future?
Not sleeping.
I believe that.
Yeah, a lot of that actually. So we're focused on two primary things right now. So the first one has to do with development and defining of the protocol and the yellow paper, which we're making good progress with. Also hiring and expanding our team around the. Both back-end development, blockchain development, and app development. At the same time, we're focused right now on our private stuff, currently.
Okay.
And,
So you'll do the private sale, and then will you eventually do an ICO, public ICO? Is that the plan, or don't know yet? Regulations pending?
So, as far as the ICO is concerned, the public ICO, that's going to be depending on where we what portion of our funding goals we reach during the private stage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's yet to be seen.
Okay. Wow, it's fascinating. Is there anything else you would like to add about what you're doing? What, like, when you come back to Consensus next year, what's a couple good yardsticks to hold you to where you will have had a successful year if you've done A and B?
Okay. So for Consensus next year, we actually hope to be presenting on the stage. And one of our goals would then be to maybe spread some geolocated tokens for the audience to pick up and to interact with. So that could be an interesting use case and interactive experience for the audience.
Yeah.
But we're actually planning on participating and presenting at various conferences over the next 6 months. So you might see us in LA in October and a few other places. I mean, Tokyo.
Would that be BlockCon in October?
Possibly, yeah.
Okay, good.
And in the technical layer, by next year, we would have hopefully a first specification release for the W3C for the location credential. And if anybody listening is interested in participating in the credential community, the W3C is an open community. We welcome all participants. Just type in the distributed identifier or verifiable credentials. You'll find me there along with other interesting and amazing people. It's the World Wide Web was kind of decentralized, and blockchain is more. And the more people get involved, the more we can build together.
All right, guys, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Alan, Lionel. I think this is great. You know, this is the reason why you should come to conventions. You just never know you're going to run into the opportunities you're going to see and things you're going to go home with that you're going to learn about. So that's it. We'll see you guys next
week. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Darren. Thank you.
Monuments crumble.